of Christ's return. Now, the phrase sign of the times is one that it would be familiar to quite a lot of people, not just Berean Christadelphians and not just Christians or religious people generally. It's frequently in the workplace. They may someone read something on the BBC in their lunch hour, and I've heard it at least once, probably twice or three times, where someone will say, oh, it's a sign of the times. Yeah, a sign of the times, but a sign of what? Truly, it's a sign that the world really is a wicked place, some of the things that they note reading on the BBC. It's a sign that this country, if excluding all other countries in the world, is fast on its way to a state of moral and social chaos. The fact is, this is a problem throughout the world, as we know. We could spend the next hour talking about the problems that will and have resulted from Islamic State. We could spend the next hour talking about the corruption that is in the world. We can cite the problems at Tesco, to name but one example. Bear in mind, we don't even know half of the corruption that really does go on, because most of it is kept under close wraps. At this very moment in time, the police in West London are looking for a 14-year-old girl. So we could spend forever talking about the multitude of problems that are in the world, and the world, as we say, is prepared to admit this. even the most hard-nosed denier of a God, the hard-nosed denier of even Jesus Christ's existence, would have to admit that the world is a melting pot at the moment in many more ways than one. But the purpose of this address is not to just highlight the problems that are in the world. What we wish to prove is, as our lecture says, that the signs point not just to Christ's return, but to the fact that Christ's return is imminent. And we are reluctant to say when, but we feel that we can say fairly confidently that we aren't talking more than a few years away at the most. And we'll try and prove that this afternoon in a few ways. So we'll start with a quote from the scripture. This is a parable of Christ. He said in Mark chapter 13, verse 28, "Now learn a parable of the fig tree. When her branch is yet tender and putteth forth leaves, ye know that summer is near. So ye, in like manner, when ye shall see these things come to pass, know that it is nigh, even at the doors. Verily I say unto you, that this generation shall not pass till all these things be done. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away. But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son, but the Father. Take ye heed, watch and pray, for ye know not when the time is. For the Son of Man is as a man taking a far journey, who left his house and gave authority to his servants, and to every man his work, and commanded the porter to watch. Watch ye therefore, for ye know not when the master of the house cometh, at even, or at midnight, or at the cock crowing, or in the morning, lest coming suddenly he find you sleeping. And what I say to you, I say to all, watch." So clearly, we have a command. This isn't just advice, this is a command to watch. And that's what we need to consider this afternoon. Now, Christ here is addressing a few issues. The start of the quotation we looked at there is referring to the Jewish commonwealth, which would pass away. But then he moves on to speak of the time when Christ would actually return. He predicts that the Son of Man would take a far journey. That is, the Son of Man, that's the Lord Jesus Christ, is even now taking a far journey. He is away from the earth. He sits on his Father's right hand, but he will return, as he said. And he will come as, in this case, as the master of the house. And the point that we need to note is that we need to be aware of the coming of the master of the house and to be ready for it. So, we watch. What do we watch? We have signs in everyday life. Our lives are actually governed by reactions and responses to various signs. The Lord Jesus Christ actually referred to one. He said about when the fig tree putteth forth her leaves, you know that summer is nigh. That's an everyday sign that the agriculturalist needs to be aware of. We in our day are familiar with road signs. We know that sign there. It's not a particularly dangerous one, I suppose, but that it's a railway crossing without barriers. We would be fools then to sort of take that sign for granted and park our car on the railway track and go shopping. We have other general signs, like the one that warns of radiation. We have signs, perhaps health warnings, and those are all too acutely aware. We're all too acutely aware of certain health signs. There may be problems which are ominous of an illness which may even threaten our lives if not responded to. So we're used to those sort of warnings. We're obviously used to weather. That picture there would suggest to us, I'm sure we all agree, that's an evening with a red sky, that tomorrow is likely to be a good sunny day. And perhaps the most pertinent one of all is the map that we have there of the southwest of England, the Cornish coast, which is known to be a treacherous shipping route. The whole coast of Cornwall is absolutely littered with shipwrecks. So to the navigator then, the captain of a ship, he does well in reading and understanding his maps and being able, not just to read and understand his maps, but to be able to translate that into what he sees with his own eyes when his vessel is progressing around the Cornish coast, or any coastline for that matter. There are various signs that manifest themselves to him. The increasing choppiness of the waves, the colour of the water, etc., etc. They're all signs that the captain should know and be aware of. So signs are not something that is a strange concept to us, and we actually use signs more than we actually are aware of. The question is, and this is the very pertinent question here, does our understanding of those signs make any difference to the outcome? We can pretend that we are totally ignorant of what that yellow sign with a sort of a fan means. Does that mean that our ignorance means that there is no radioactive material that will threaten our existence? Or, in the case of the captain of the ship, does the fact that perhaps he doesn't understand his map, and we know that the French in the time of Nelson and Napoleon weren't so adept at reading maps, and it somewhat cost them, cost them a lot actually, but is the captain in a position to use ignorance? Will ignorance prevent his ship running on the rocks? Clearly not. Seems an obvious conclusion to come to. But the point is, when we stand here and consider what is going on in the world, ignorance will not bar us from what we believe, and which we will shortly prove, is the inevitable outcome. And that's something that we need to keep in our minds as we consider this subject this afternoon, that ignorance does not protect us at all. In actual fact, ignorance is more dangerous than anything. And as we were discussing earlier, the government seems to think that keeping people in ignorance is the better thing, because the last thing they want is people with more and more psychological complaints throwing themselves up bridges because of the fear of what will happen in the world. And we look at some of these things as we feel they will happen shortly. But in actual fact, the best thing one can do is warn someone. If someone was on a hike or on a path which had just collapsed because of the bad winter we had, we may not want to spoil his walk, but wouldn't we be kinder to that person to tell him that he's probably better avoiding this path because of the dangers it entails? Clearly then, it's better to be warned than left in ignorance. So, we will, look at times, and we will look at signs. Now, we could look at the social unrest in Britain, and the US and Europe generally. We could look at natural disasters, which seem to be increasing in frequency, even if not in intensity. We could look at economic uncertainty. We could look at global politics. But what we wish to do, because we feel they're the two most clearly indicative, without any obstacle, is look at times and what we might term global politics. They are unassailable indications of the time in which we live there, and they clearly point to the fact that Christ is shortly to return. So in Daniel chapter 8, we read, "Behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed, the end shall be." So that's the first thing to bear in mind. There is a time appointed. There is a time appointed when the end of all things Gentile will come. So that means we have an interest in these things, because there is a time appointed. If the things aren't to continue capriciously as they appear to be, they do appear to be sort of, no one seems to know what the solution is to the Middle East problem, to the economic problem. Things seem to be going in just a very chaotic way. But God is in control, and there is a time appointed for all these things to end. Some may say, "Well, Paul said to the Thessalonians, 'But of the times and the seasons, brethren, ye have no need that I write unto you, for yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so cometh as a thief in the night.' But therefore, why concern ourselves with these things, that the day of the Lord so cometh as a thief in the night? So we really needn't worry about these things." Well, he says, "But ye, brethren, are not in darkness, that that day should overtake you as a thief." So we then do not have the excuse of saying, "Well, we don't need to worry about the signs of the times, because it's going to come as a thief anyway." It shouldn't come as a thief to us. Anyone who cares about their future will not be taken unawares. And Paul actually says in his second epistle to them, "Remember ye not that when I was with you, I told you these things." He had already told them of what would happen as various signs would unveiled before Christ would return. So we have no excuse for not looking at the signs of the times. We cannot plead ignorance, as we said earlier on. So let's turn to Daniel chapter 12, which our president read for us as an introduction to our consideration this afternoon. Daniel chapter 12, we read verse 1. "And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince that standeth for the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was, since there was a nation even at that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one shall be found written in the book. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness, stars forever and ever." So here is the end, or one angle, if you like, of the time of the end. That at the time of the end, those who are responsible will be raised. Some will be raised to glory, and some will be raised to condemnation. But look at verse 1. We have to conclude, as we sort of summarise very briefly, not exhaustively, on the screen behind us, that it would be a time of trouble, and it would be a time of trouble such as never was. Now, I've spoken to several people in the world who feel that the world is geared up, or sort of is heading for another world war. Of course, they hope that it's not going to be in their time, or their children or grandchildren's time, but one would have to be pretty thick not to see that there's a time of trouble such as never was coming. I mean, we only have to look at the capabilities of military equipment to realise that when some of this is unleashed, it's going to be seriously bad news. These Trident missiles that the US and the UK have, just one of those warheads, and bear in mind, each missile carries, I think it's 8 warheads, one of those warheads has more firepower than all the firepower of World War II, and more explosive power, I mean. That's a pretty scary thought, and we don't know for definite whether these missiles will ever be used, because they're more than capable of wiping out entire continents. But still, the point is, we have a lot of military hardware that is capable of causing severe suffering. So if the world does descend into another war, it's going to be seriously bad news. And I think we can all see that the way things are in the world, that's not a far-fetched conclusion. that we can see from this chapter that it's also coetaneous with the resurrection and the deliverance of God's people. In verse 4, "Thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." So we also understand that there'll be lots of running to and fro. There has never been an age like this where people run to and fro. The average person can afford to fly to the other side of the globe. And of course, we've even got the case that man has landed on the moon. So we really do have a case of running to and fro. And that's easy to see. We have an exponential increase in knowledge. Since the late 1700s, the latter part of the 18th century, knowledge has just absolutely exploded. And what we do as a matter of course today, like driving our car, flying, using our mobile phones, would have been totally unexpected and almost, well, was beyond belief. Even as recently as the 1890s and early 1900s. So we have this exponential increase in knowledge. It's not profitable knowledge, it's not knowledge that's going to save us in the time of the end, but still, we can't deny the fact that there has been an explosion in knowledge as a result of the Industrial Revolution. And that there would be an end of Israel's scattering. Thy people, that's Daniel's people, would be delivered. We believe that's a two-pronged application. That's not just Abraham's natural descendants, but Abraham's spiritual descendants. That's those who have adopted the hope of Israel. So there would be an end of Israel's scattering. My friends, this is our time. This is the time in which we live. This time of trouble, which is spoken of here, is the time when there would be an exponential increase in knowledge, when Israel's scattering would come to an end, when people would be running to and fro. This is the time in which you and I live. So let's see what the Bible can tell us as far as whether it predicts the time of the end to be in our time or not, even aside from what we looked at in Daniel chapter 12. Later on in that same chapter, we read in verse 7, "And I heard the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and swear by him that liveth forever, that it shall be for a time, times and an half, when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished." So, what we really mean there, as we would find if we turn to the book of Revelation, is that it's a time, two times, and half a time. Now, time in Hebrew is generally accepted to be a year, which in the Hebrew calendar is 360 days. So one 360 days, two 360 days, and half of a 360 days, which gives us 1,260 days. We also have, towards the end of the chapter, and we're not actually going to look at these, so I should really have them on the slide, really, but 1,290 days referred to in verse 11, and 1,335 days referred to in verse 12. So Daniel, having received the vision of the 11th chapter, when he saw a picture of this king of the north and the king of the south, which you don't have time to look at this afternoon, certainly not the king of the south, but and also the persecution of his people at the hands of the king of the north, and the fulfillment and the promise that this would the conflict between the king of the north and the king of the south, with Israel stuck as piggy in the middle, so to speak, suffering badly at the hands of the king of the north, would precipitate the return of Christ to the earth. Daniel says, well, how long? In verse 6. And the answer is, for a time, times, and half time. So we have to identify how long this is, which we hope to do. We also have, in Daniel chapter 7, we have the Daniel chapter 7 and verse 25. They shall be given into his hand until the time and times and the dividing of time. So again, we have this 1,260 days referred to here. This is the time which the saints, that's the faithful, that's the people like Daniel and the Apostle Paul, Peter and John, people like that, people we believe like the Berean Christadelphians would be given into the hands of these, which are the believers of the Berean Christadelphians, would be given into the hands of this fourth beast. And we have in Daniel chapter 8, and in verse 14, and Daniel asks in verse 13, Daniel spoke to another, "How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot?" And he said unto me, "Until 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed." So we have a few mile markers then, if you like, to enable us to understand approximately the time when we can expect the indignation of heaven to be unleashed against the kingdom of men. But what we have to do first, because all we've been given is days, and if we limit these things to days, then everything should have happened a long, long time ago. We should now be living in the blissful kingdom age. We're clearly not living in the kingdom age. We're not living in the time which is promised in the likes of Psalm 72, and when Jesus has not returned to reign over Israel on David's throne. That's clearly not happened. So we can't be referring to days here. And as one expositor reminds us, when we symbolise something, we don't symbolise something smaller or equal to it by a symbol. We looked at those road signs and the sort of the hazardous sign of radiation. We don't expect the hazardous radiation sign to represent something that may hurt your finger or something like that. Those signs represent something that's going to cause a serious, serious harm. And the same in the scriptures. We don't see 2,300 days and think, well, it may be talking about 23 minutes. Or, for that matter, 2,300 days. It would be pointless putting it in the proximity of symbol. The very nature of prophecy and symbology means that it's prophesying something bigger than what we have there. So we have to identify then what days are. In Genesis 47 verse 9, Jacob said unto Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and have not attained into the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage." So Jacob sort of refers to days as meaning the days of the years of his life. In Numbers, Moses warns the children of Israel, "Your children shall wander in the wilderness 40 years and bear your whoredoms until your carcasses be wasted in the wilderness. After the number of the days in which ye search the land, even 40 days, each day for a year, shall ye bear your iniquities, even 40 years, and ye shall know my breach of promise. I have appointed thee each day for a year." So Yahweh, speaking through Moses, says that according to the days of their iniquities, each day would be a day for a year that they would wander in the wilderness. And we have one more in Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 4. Lay thou also upon thy left side, and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it, according to the number of the days that thou shalt lie upon it, thou shalt bear their iniquity. For I have laid upon thee the years of their iniquity, according to the number of the days, 390 days. So shalt thou bear the iniquity of the house of Israel. Without going into the dating of this, we believe that from the time of Solomon, approximately, up until the time of Ezekiel, was about 390 years. And he wasn't commanded to lay on his side for 390 years, because at the end of it, they would only have been Ezekiel's skeleton. He was told to lie 390 days on his side as an indication of the number of the years that Israel had disobeyed God. So clearly, a day in prophetic terminology represents a year. And we can bear that out very quickly by looking at Daniel chapter 9 verse 24. We won't turn to it, but we're told there about the 70-week prophecy, which would be from the time of the commencement of the command to rebuild the temple, which was given to the Persian king, up until the time of Christ, would be 70 weeks. Well, 70 weeks amounts to 490 days. The instruction from the Persian king, Cyrus, to rebuild the temple was in BC 456. 490 years later, we came to the year that Christ was crucified and raised again, approximately AD 34. So we have a demonstration then that 70 weeks, which is 490 days, does not mean 490 literal days, because Christ came 470 odd years after this, the period when the temple was reconstructed, and he accomplished what he was sent to do. He took away transgression, he took away sin. So we have there an indication of how the day for a year principle works. So we can then say that the time, times and half a time, as we've seen in Daniel 12 and Daniel 7, is 1,260 years, not days. The 1,290 days is 1,290 years. And the same for the other dates that we have, including the 2300 dates. So we'll start then at the 2300. Now, some manuscripts translate 2300 as 2400, and a 19th century expositor, Dr. John Thomas, also failed as 2400. I suppose, favour 2400, and that's what we base our comments on this afternoon. I wish to stress that if we do set the 2300, that really doesn't change the weight of our remarks this afternoon. That really makes no difference at all. And in one sense, you could say that it makes the issue even more urgent. So Daniel 8, verse 14, we read the 2300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. So we have to look then, because the context is the treading down of the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot. We're talking about Israel here, the host of Israel. So they would be trodden down for 2,300, or I'm now going to refer to 2,400 days, which we've identified as years. So 2,400 years, Israel would be trodden underfoot. So when does that begin? We don't believe that that can begin in the Persian reign. Yes, the Babylonians took Israel captive, but there was a glimmer of hope, and the Persians, they re-established Israel in the land. They didn't re-establish the monarchy of Israel, but they did re-establish Israel in the land. That sadly changed under the Greeks. In BC 334, at the Battle of Granicus, Alexander defeated the last Persian emperor, and the Persian Empire became no more. We now enter the days of the Greek Empire, and the Semitic policy of the Greeks was very different to the policy of the Persians. While the Persians had been pro-Semitic and supportive of the Israeli state, the Greeks were not so. And without going into details, we can read of lots of things where the Greeks, especially with Alexander's successor, the Seleucus, his general, was particularly unfavourably disposed to the Jews. So we believe then that at this battle we can sort of commence our clock ticking for 2,400 years. This was the time when Israel would lose all their freedom. The Greeks never afforded the Jews any freedom, and in actual fact even managed to Hellenize some of them, and that's how we end up with the Sadducees in the days of Christ. Well, what do we get if we had 2,400 to BC 334? Obviously 334 would be a minus figure. We get to the year 2066. Well, that's a generation away from where we are. But, and we don't wish to go into this, but you can look in your own time in books like Micah, which is a reference to the Exodus, that it took Israel 40 years to come out of the land of Egypt. And it says that according to the number of the days of thy coming out of Egypt, will the time of their regathering be. So we have a minimum of 40 years in the setting up of the kingdom. And in actual fact, if we were to put many facts together, we really don't have time to go into that this afternoon, I think we can conclude that it's 50 years. So Christ will, we believe, would return on the Jubilee, and the kingdom would be fully established and inaugurated at the next Jubilee, the Jubilee being 50 years and is a significant time period in the Jewish calendar. That takes us to 2016. So if Christ were to return in 2016, the kingdom would be fully established and inaugurated in 2066. Now, do we feel safe in making that conclusion? Well, I don't wish to be dogmatic on this. There is even some discrepancy as to whether it even is 2,400. Some believe that it is 2,300. But if you turn quickly to Ezekiel 39, bear in mind, we're looking for the time when the sanctuary would be cleansed. And when we say the sanctuary, we believe that that's the land of Israel. Ezekiel chapter 39 and verse 12 says, 7 months shall the house of Israel be burying of them, that they may cleanse the land. This, we will come to this later, very briefly later. This is the time when Israel will have undergone their final judgment because of the rebellion against God, and ultimate, and particularly the rejection of his son, the Messiah. So at this time, Israel will be cleansing the land. This, we believe, is the equivalent of what Daniel sees as the end of this 2400. So once Israel begin to cleanse the land of all the troops that will have been slain there, the cleansing process will begin. But it won't be completed. The kingdom won't be fully appreciated because the 10 tribes, this is really going off our subject to an extent, will not be regathered until the end of the 40 years, as we said, Micah refers to. So we believe that this is 2066, and give or take a few years, I think we can safely conclude we are in that time. This is the time in which we are living in. So let's move on then to the time, times and a half. We had the time referred to in Daniel chapter 12, and we have one in Daniel chapter 7, and this touches on one of the signs that we will consider later. We're talking about the fourth beast here. Daniel saw a vision of four beasts, which equated to the vision that Nebuchadnezzar saw of the image standing upon its feet, which was to be smashed by the stone cut out of the mountain without hands. The beasts equated to the metals, the gold, the silver, the brass, and the iron. This fourth beast equates to the two legs of the image, which was iron, and clearly represents the Roman Empire. And that's not in dispute, other than a certain group of people, which maybe we'll touch on later. This fourth beast was to conquer the whole earth and the habitable regions. Verse 25 of Daniel chapter 7 says, we'll start at verse 23. Thus he said, "The fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down, and break it in pieces. And the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them. And he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue 3 kings. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change time and laws. And they shall be given into his hand until time and times, and the dividing of time." So, this is a beast then, which conquers the whole earth, or we mean the habitable regions of the earth. It wouldn't conquer the South Africa or Australasia or anything. They weren't part of the habitable world at that time. When the historians referred to the end of the world that the Tyrians went to, they didn't actually meet Cape Horn in South America or anything. They were literally referring to what was beyond Spain, because to them that was the end of the world. So this was an empire that conquered the whole earth. Out of this, these 10 horns would arise. 3 of those horns would be demolished in favour of another little horn, which would have unique properties. This horn would be blasphemous, and it is through this horn that 1,260 years of persecution for the saints would be experienced. So we're clearly talking about, as we said, the fourth empire, which is the one on the bottom right, which looks as much like an irony kind of colour as possible, is the Roman Empire. And this was the empire that would have this little horn arising out of it. Now, before we get to that little horn, we have to consider the 10 horns. We could quote from Sir Isaac Newton, but he was a Christian, and one might accuse us of being biased. So we quote from someone who was not a Christian, not interested in these prophecies at all, but gave us, strangely enough, 10 tribes that inhabited the Roman Empire, and eventually subsumed themselves into the Roman Empire. So while there was no Caesar by this time, while there was the imperial side of things in Rome had sort of disappeared, still, rather than they becoming an Ostrogoth Empire or a Saxon Empire, they absorbed themselves into the Roman Empire, and thus we have a 10-horned Roman, but still imperial, beast. But we have a little horn which conquers 3 of them, so we're down to 7th plus this 11th the assembled means plus this 11th form. Who is this 11th form? Well, again, we don't actually have to go to religious sources to find out what happened here. In the late 8th century, a man by the name of Pepin annexed three kingdoms to the papacy. It's known as a donation of Pepin. He was obviously favourable to the papacy, and he annexed the kingdom of Lombardy, the Exarchate of Ravenna, and the kingdom of Rome. Those he donated to the Pope. As a reward for that, Charlemagne, his son, and Charlemagne was instrumental in this as well, was crowned the Holy Roman Emperor on, note, Christmas Day in AD 799. So we have then this Holy Roman Emperor, which was crowned by the papacy. Why is that significant? Because we aren't talking about a merely military power when we think of Charlemagne. We're actually talking about, yes, a military power, but one which had the blessing of the biggest religious system in the world at that time, the papacy, the Roman Catholic Church. Now that's significant, because what did we read in Daniel chapter 7? And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws. And they, that's the saints, shall be given into his hand until the time and times and the dividing of time. So, we have then a system which would persecute the saints of God. This can only be attributed to the Roman Catholic Church. And anyone who cares to look into this will find that this is so. We only have to look at not too distant history to find out what happened to people like William Tyndale. I forget their names now. William Flower, was it? People like this were all burnt at the stake. Why? Just because they didn't really agree with the Roman Catholic faith. And we pick up Fox's Book of Martyrs and see what it has to say about the Roman Catholic Church and how it treated people who didn't, who had the misfortune of not actually agreeing with what the Roman Catholic Church said. This can only refer to the papacy. This can only refer to the papacy. The Muslim faith, which is the only one that we could perhaps say that it was instead, was never so disposed towards those who didn't who shared the same views as Daniel. In actual fact, initially, although it's different now, we have to admit, the Muslim faith only attacked the institutions of Roman Catholicism. They actually spared some of the small Christian denominations, like the Berean Christadelphians today then. Small denominations like that were spared by the Muslim faith. So this clearly does not refer to the Muslims. It refers to the Roman Catholic faith with the papacy at its head. I'm not sure whether we have the time to look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. We really don't. So we'll skip that one and basically say that we'll identify some time periods with 1260 starts. Ignore 313 because we're running out of time. So 533, Justinian, I have a quote here from that same expositor in the 18th, 19th century, John Thomas, in a celebrated letter written by the Emperor Justinian to this god of patron saints. So this is before the Pope had gained the kind of power that he had in the days of Charlemagne. This Emperor Justinian writes to what was the Bishop of Rome then, in 533, and he said, "On which thenceforth became part and parcel of the civil law, he is recognized as the legal head of all the churches of the eastern and western provinces of the empire. We suffer not, says the imperial writer, anything that belongs to the state of the churches to be done without submitting it to your holiness," etc., etc. That's enough to be able to get the flavour of just what this Emperor Justinian did to the Pope. He elevated him to the next level and said that he's the legal head of all the churches. So that's a significant event. And in 608, Phocas declared the Pope to be the universal bishop. So essentially, the Pope can't get any higher now. I mean, he's head of all the churches, and he is now the universal bishop. That basically gives him power over everything. So we have those two significant dates, 533 and 608. Now, there was times and a half, which was 1,260 years, as we've identified, that they would blaspheme and they would persecute. So we need to find an end date, and that's fairly simple. AD 533 plus 1260 takes us up to 1793, and AD 608 and plus 1260 takes us to 1868. Are those days significant? Are they ever? 1793 was the French Revolution. We asked, what does the French Revolution have to do with the papacy? Wasn't that against the aristocracy of France? Yes, who were the aristocracy of France? The aristocracy of France was a Roman Catholic institutionalized system that owned, hand in hand with the church, something like 85 or 90% of all the land in France. So the biggest asset of France was owned by a church slash aristocratic hand in hand glove aristocracy. So we really do have the French Revolution pointed against Roman Catholicism. And we only have to sort of read what some of the things that Robespierre did. He sort of instituted the God of Reason and etc., etc. It was all against the church. It was very much an undermining of the Church of Rome. And as we will know, what came out of the French Revolution was the French Revolutionary Wars, where Napoleon was the hero. What did he do? He pretty much smashed Roman Catholic influence in Europe. He certainly smashed the armies of the papacy, namely the Austrians, and basically weakened the Roman Catholic faith. Well, by 1868, that process had by no means abated. And the people like Victor Emmanuel and Garibaldi, the Pope, lost all of his influence. History tells us that that was the time when the papacy lost its temporal power. Again, what does that lead us to conclude? Skipping through that fairly quickly, it tells us that we are in that time. We are somewhere there. We have seen the 42 months, the time times and a half, that's 1,260 years, expire. We are coming towards the end of the 2,400 days, or evening morning periods. We are nearly at the end of this time period. There is nothing left to happen before Christ can return. And if we were to slide that arrow to the left, to sort of the 11th or 12th centuries, we would have to say that the papacy hasn't lost its power yet. Even though we could still say that Christ could remove the power there and then. But 1,260 years had to elapse, whereby the Pope can blaspheme the God of heaven and can persecute the saints. Those years have elapsed, so there is nothing left to happen. So we've looked at times, and I spent a lot longer than I actually intended there. And we look at three, we could look at others. It would be interesting to look at Turkey. We take Turkey for granted. Turkey is just a holiday destination now, isn't it? Once upon a time, the Ottoman Empire was a great empire, and it's predicted in Revelation chapter 16 that it would weaken. Well, we take that for granted because we just think of Turkey as a third world empire. But it wasn't always so. And in fact, go back 250 years and it was an empire to be contended with. But the scriptures predicted 2,000 years ago that it would weaken, and it has. So we will look at Israel, and a Christadelphian named Robert Roberts said, "It is the Jew who is the greatest sign." This was written in the 1890s. And that's incredible. The Jew, even in his day, was the greatest sign. How much of a great sign is it today with so many developments under our belt? Jeremiah 30 verse 10 says, "Fear thou not, O my servant Jacob, saith the Lord, neither be dismayed, O Israel, for lo, I will save thee from afar, and thy seed from the land of thy captivity." Israel knows. He was referred to as the wandering Jew. So they were taken into captivity under the Austrians, under the Germans, under the Russians, sadly even under the British at some times, under the Spanish particularly. They suffered immensely. They weren't even allowed to run away. They were captive in those countries, and they certainly suffered in that captivity. And God says, "Though I make a full end of all nations, but I have scattered thee, yet will I not make a full end of thee. But I will correct thee in measure, and will not leave thee altogether unpunished." So that in itself is proof that the prophecies we looked at we can trust in, and that God has not made a full end of the Jews. So the dispersion began in AD 70 when the Romans destroyed their city, destroyed their temple, and expelled them. The Bar Kokhba revolt in 132 AD failed. And the various time periods, the land of Israel fell under numerous conquerors. We were told yesterday that approximately 70 conquerors have set foot in Israel. So in 2,000 years, approximately 70 conquerors have set foot in Jerusalem. The last time Congress set foot in London was in 1066. So that gives us some perspective of just how much Israel, the land of Israel, has suffered as a result of Israel's disobedience. And we know that they were generally persecuted all through the Middle Ages, and it was only the Protestant Reformation which really changed anything. So fast forward to 1791, when, again it's interesting, as a result of the French Revolution, the Jews were emancipated in France. So the French Revolution wasn't just against Roman Catholicism, it proved that Roman Catholicism was anti-Semitic, because it was only when the Roman Catholic power of France was removed, that the Jew could enjoy liberation. And we know that Napoleon held a great Sanhedrin, he wanted Jews to return to Israel. Simon Montefiore was knighted because of his interference in favour of the Jews by Queen Victoria. The downside is that pogroms began, but that was in itself instrumental because it brought about a need to find a homeland for the Jews. And in 1897, the first Zionist Congress was held, which was the brainchild of that man pictured on the right, Theodore Herzl. So this is all fast moving now, but we've got to fly through this. Continuing, General Allenby in 1917, during the First World War, liberated Jerusalem from the power of the Turk. This was a major turning point in the history of Israel. It now vacated the spiritual capital and the capital of Palestine, really, from the Turkish power, and was, as we said, at the same time, a fulfillment of Revelation chapter 16, which said that the Turkish power would dry up. In 1918, Lord Arthur Balfour made a declaration which promised that the land of Palestine would become a homeland for the Jews, and that Britain would support that. And in 1948, though by no means anything like as simple as what we're making it sound, Israel became a state. By 2010, they're the 17th most economically developed country in the world. That's incredible. 17th doesn't sound particularly high, but I know there's over 200 countries in the world, and that's phenomenal for a country that is one of the youngest countries there are. So in the light of Bible prophecy, where does that put us? We probably can't turn any of those up, so we would just... Well, we will turn up Luke chapter 21. We could turn up Zechariah chapter 14. And the reason we were going to turn that one up is because if we were to turn to Zechariah chapter 14, we would find the prediction of the Jewish state being attacked by this fierce king, and half the city would go into captivity. Well, for that to happen, we had to have a restoration of the Jews. If we turn to Ezekiel chapter 37, we have the vision of dry bones, where Ezekiel saw the picture of these bones which is lying scattered, a picture of Israel's condition throughout most of the Middle Ages, and that these bones would come together, sinews would be added to it and flesh added until they would stand up. So we would have turned there to see that. But in Luke chapter 21 verse 24, Christ said, "They shall fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled." Well, that's significant then, because we see that Jerusalem would, even after Christ, we know that it was trodden down by the Babylonians, nearly trodden down by the Assyrians as well, then by the Greeks, but this is all after that now. So after Christ's time, Jerusalem would be trodden down by the Gentiles. Until when? Until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. We don't believe that the time of the Gentiles has yet quite ended, but we are seeing the signs that that time is nearly upon us. That Jerusalem is no longer trodden down by the Gentiles in the way it has been. We don't see the crusader planting the cross in Jerusalem anymore. Yes, the damage is already there. But we don't see the crusader attack in Jerusalem. We don't see altogether the Roman Catholics actively trying to conquer Jerusalem. There's all sorts of subversive things going on that the Pope is interested in trying to get Jerusalem back and admit. But the Jews are now well and truly in control of Jerusalem. This is our time. We are living in the time when the times of the Gentiles are nearly fulfilled, when Jerusalem is no longer trodden down with the Gentiles as it has been. As we said, this is not completely fulfilled. There's still a lot of work to do. We only need to walk through Jerusalem for about half an hour before we've seen about 10 churches. So this is not a work, this is still a work in progress, but we are seeing this work having been partly fulfilled. What about Russia then? I think probably Scripture, we were going to look at the papacy as well. But we won't. A certain individual said, we should acknowledge that the collapse of the Soviet Union was a major geopolitical disaster of the century, that's the 20th century. If it was someone like Derek Wilson, a historian, saying that, we wouldn't be so worried. If it was the Chinese Premier, or Ahmadinejad, or President Assad saying that, we wouldn't be so worried. The point is, that man said it. That's Vladimir Putin, who is the head of the Russian economy, the head of the Russian country, the Russian Federation. The man who is actively building up the Russian military war machine. He's the man that said that the fall of the Soviet Union was a major geopolitical disaster of the 20th century. So that's, I mean, he is, people may not want to admit it, and I think that's because they're afraid to admit it, he is one of the most aggressive leaders that there are today. And he's at the head of one of the most powerful countries that there are today. That bodes badly for world peace. So very quickly then, because Russia is mentioned in the scripture, which may be a surprise, how was this empire formed? We fast forwarded from its original time and the Rurik in 880, etc. to 1328. We wish to show just how much this country has grown. From 4,656 square miles under the Grand Duchy of Moscow to 125,000 square miles. Under the Empire of Russia, that's under Tsarist Russia, in 1725 it was 273,000. And it grew through Catherine the Great and Peter the Great, etc., to 367,000. Of course, by the time of the Soviet Union, it ballooned to over 8 million square miles. And with the fall of the USSR, it shrank again. But still a phenomenal country. It spans 9 time zones. Even the US, I believe, only has 4 time zones. Russia spans 9 time zones and has an area of 6.5 million square miles. So we are talking about a vast country, which has come out of nowhere. You look back through the annals of history, and earlier than 800-900 AD, Russia, the Rus, were just more or less a tribe. And yet here they are, threatening world peace against all the old empires that the world could throw at it. In the light of Bible prophecy then, what do we find? In Daniel chapter 11, we have reference to the king of the north and the king of the south, which we briefly referred to earlier. Daniel 11 verse 40. At that time of the end, shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries, and shall overthrow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, etc., etc. So there will be this conflict then at the time of the end. A parallel of the old Greek wars, where the Seleucids and the Ptolemies fought against each other. I don't think Antiochus ever fought against the Seleucids. But what we wish to say here is that the king of the south and the king of the north is king of the north and south relative to Israel. So what we expect to see then, because in verse 45 says, he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end. And then shall help him, and at that time shall Michael stand up, Michael being a reference to Christ. So there would be a repetition of this. Who is the king of the north and who is the king of the south? And we believe that the king of the south is Britain. We really don't have time to prove this, but we could turn to Ezekiel chapter 38 to show this. This king of the north has to be powerful enough to rival the powers of the south, or the western powers. This power has to be anti-Semitic. It has to be Greek. Well, what is the religion of Russia? It's Greek Orthodox. And it has to be from the north places. Now that excludes Syria, like Damascus, Lebanon, Iraq. They're never described as the north places in the Bible. The north places means somewhere further north than that. Somewhere beyond the Caucasus region, which takes us into the area of Kazan, etc., which is Russia, and then further north, we're into the area of Moscow and Tobolsky. Have to skip that slide. And these ones really. What we wish to say is, in 2014, in light of recent events, we believe that we can identify the growing intentions of Russia to fulfill Bible prophecy. And again, we wish you to turn in your own time to Ezekiel chapter 38. We didn't have time to turn there to see what is predicted of Russia there, because Russia is clearly mentioned in Ezekiel chapter 38. In February, Russia invaded Crimea. That's no news to anybody. Russia became independent, in inverted commas, in May, and joined the Russian Federation in July and June. Fighting escalates in eastern Ukraine, and even now has not actually died down yet. And of course, it all came to a head with the shooting down of the Malaysian Airlines flight over Ukraine using weaponry supplied by Russia. Even this week, on Wednesday, I believe it was, in the news, we found that Putin has ordered the building of 80 new warships to be stationed on his newly found territory in Crimea, expanding his Black Sea fleet. And we found today that he's hoping to have a fleet of 280 ships just in the Black Sea. So Vladivostok and the east coast of Russia and Murmansk in the north are not even included here. 280 ships just in the Black Sea. And of course, that picture there is not unusual. The Admiral Kulikov is an interesting ship. It's an anti-submarine ship and had to be escorted out of British waters by HMS Dragon. Light of anti-Semitism, we could spend some time there, but we won't. I will quote from the will of Peter the Great, who said, "The All-Powerful, from whom we hold our life and our throne, permits us to look upon Russia as being called upon to establish her rule over all Europe." That is it's almost as if he lifted that from the Bible when we turn to Ezekiel chapter 38. I'm sorry, I don't have time to turn it. This idea is based upon the fact that all the nations of this portion of the globe are fast approaching a state of utter decrepitude. The emigration of men from the north is like the inundation of the Nile, which at certain seasons enriches with its waters the arid plains of Egypt. We found Russia, a small rivulet. We leave it, an immense river. Our successors will make of it an ocean, destined to fertilize the whole of Europe if they know how to guide its waves. That's an interesting insight into the will of Peter the Great. And I'm quite sure that Vladimir Putin can almost recite that off by heart. Papacy, we've got to skip there. And pause just by referring to the last two slides that we have, which in Luke chapter 21, verse 33, we read earlier on, "Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. Take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness and cares of this life, and so that day come upon you unawares. For so it's like a trap, an animal just going along, enjoying its own business, and bam, it's caught in a snare. That's how the coming of the Son of Man, the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ, will be to all those that dwell upon the face of the whole earth." For us, you and I, who have an opportunity, bless those servants whom the Lord, when he comes, shall find watching. Verily I say unto you that he shall gird himself and make them to sit down to meat, and will come forth and serve them. And if he shall come in the second watch, or come in the third watch, and find them so, blessed are those servants. And this know, that if the good man of the house had known not how the thief would come, he would have watched, and not have suffered his house to be broken through. Be ye therefore ready also, for the Son of Man cometh at an hour when ye think not."